Something we'll be considering to a large extent in the coming chapters, including this one, is the concept of cooperation. In cooperation, what we have is more than one entity helping out each other. This can result in an increase in, for example, the functionality or the fitness of the entity that's being helped. It can also result in a decline in the fitness or functionality of the entity that's doing the helping. Generally, we see cooperation evolving within systems in which there's some kind of reproductive linkage between the individuals that in fact are cooperating. In this way, by giving to another, one can potentially enhance one's own reproductive success. And whenever that's the case, there is a reasonable probability that in fact cooperation can be stably maintained within a system. Going even further, we can look at our own bodies. Our own bodies consist of populations of cooperating cells. Most of these cells do not contribute to the next generation. Only the germline in our cells do that. However, by cooperating among themselves, they can increase the likelihood that, in fact, the body as a whole will successfully reproduce, since all of the cells within our body, more or less, possess the same genotype. As a consequence, by increasing the potential for the reproductive cells, the germline, to reproduce, we in fact are increasing, or our individual cells are increasing, their own likelihood that their genotype will be passed on to the next generation. Here in this chapter, we'll be focusing particularly on the evolution of cooperation within populations of microorganisms. In subsequent chapters, we'll be talking about variations on this theme, including in terms of the evolution of symbioses, the evolution of virulence, which has a surprising amount of cooperation involved in it, and also in terms of the evolution of greater size and complexity. Generally, what we have is a cooperative interaction in which there is an increase in fitness, but also potentially the converse, where there is a decrease in fitness, which we would describe as a defection, or instead as cheating. So in this chapter, what we'll be considering is, in fact, cooperation. So we've talked about two ways that you can think about cooperation and defection. These were the prisoner's dilemma and then briefly the game of chicken. And in both of these cases, what you have is a situation where there seemingly are compelling reasons to defect, and you have to ask the question, well, why cooperate? In an additional game-like situation called The Tragedy of the Commons, you have a similar kind of situation. Again, the question is, why cooperate when it's so compelling to instead defect? And so Tragedy of the Commons, I just made up that little abbreviation there so I could insert it in this call out. So Tragedy of the Commons is the idea that the unrestrained actions of individuals tends to lead to populations overshooting the carrying capacity of their environments. In other words, if individuals don't hold back, then they can totally destroy their environments. In this case, the commons basically is the environments, and the tragedy is the overexploitation of those environments. And so when you have individuals that have no compelling reason not to overexploit their environments, the tendency, in fact, will be for them to overexploit their environments. So Tragedy of the Commons, these are similar to N-player Prisoner's Dilemma games, where we basically have a situation where there is compelling reason for individuals to defect or to cheat. And in order for there not to be a tragedy of the commons, what you need instead are compelling reasons for individuals to, in fact, cooperate rather than defect. And a lot of what you need to understand in order to understand how cooperation can evolve are the mechanisms that, in fact, can switch the game such that instead of defection being the most compelling strategy, instead cooperation is the most compelling strategy. So restraint within the situation is cooperative. It is restraint such as in terms of one's reproduction. It's restraint in terms of one's exploitation of the environment. The question is, why shouldn't you just take? What compelling reason is there for you to constrain your taking, or even to give to, for example, common goods or public goods, rather than simply taking from public goods? So restraint is a plausible outcome. So restraint being one form of cooperation. It can be a plausible outcome given substantial reproductive linkage. Basically, if it's going to hurt in some manner, if there's going to be some cost associated with not displaying restraint, then there can be selection for displaying restraint. So if there's some cost to destroying your environment, then there can be selection for not destroying one's environment. The problem, though, is that selection tends to act on short time scales. And so, in the short term, there can be very compelling reasons, that is, strong selection for exploitation, even over-exploitation of environments. But in the long term, this can come back to haunt you. And if there is a reason to restrain yourself so that either you survive over the long term, or your kin survive over the long term, or your progeny survive over the long term, then there can be compelling reason to display restraint. And this is especially the case if you can keep cheaters from being within your midst. If you are good at exploiting your environment, but not overexploiting your environment, and a cheater can come along and basically utilize all your hard-won resources that you've been holding back from exploiting, then why bother restraining from exploitation? But if you can keep the cheaters away, then you could have a pretty good society or a pretty good population of closely related organisms that are showing restraint within their environment. And in fact, there are lots of parallels here between what humans do and what you can expect organisms as unsophisticated as viruses and bacteria will do. When you have a situation where ultimately overexploitation or cheating or defection turns out to be a costly strategy, especially in the long term, then you can have instead selection within populations, and particularly within closely related populations, or instead populations that are linked in their reproductive ability potential, then you can in fact have evolution of cooperation. So, just an interesting aside. So, this is from Hardin, 1968. This is the classic, the Tragedy of the Commons paper published in Science. So, the Tragedy of the Commons develops in this way. Picture a pasture open to all. It is expected that each herdsman will try to keep as many cattle as possible on the commons. And so, what I just want to point out is that, in fact, Hardin is using cattle rather than sheep as his example. And classically, we think of Tragedy of Commons, the example being in terms of sheep overexploiting pasture land, when in fact Hardin actually didn't use sheep, but instead cattle, for whatever it's worth. So the problem of cheating. The potential benefits of cooperation in microorganisms can be undermined by genetic conflict within social groups. So basically, you've got individuals that are not closely related to each other, which can take the form of cheating. For cooperation to succeed as an evolutionary strategy, the negative effects of such conflict must somehow be prevented or mitigated. Cheating arises from competition for the benefits derived from cooperation or altruism. So, in the case of the Tragedy of the Commons, the benefit is that you're not overexploiting the environment. So, that's a benefit derived from cooperation or altruism. If benefits that result from collective action can be obtained without contribution, then cheaters might prosper to the detriment of social groups by reducing the value of cooperation among its members. So, in this case, if you've got a group that's cooperating to not overexploit its environment, therefore kind of putting away the seed corn for the next season, you have a situation where, in fact, cheaters can come along and exploit this restraint by overexploiting the environment because it's there to be overexploited, even though others are trying to keep from overexploiting the environment. So this would be eating the seed corn. Good examples of cheaters are when insects, in fact, are not the organisms that are harvesting, are growing and harvesting grain, but they come along and they eat the grain, or when mice come along and eat the grain that's in storage for the winter or the next season. Examples of cheaters are when you have a body that's doing its best to maintain itself. You have a bunch of healthy cells, it's not a lot of cancer, and yet a parasite can come along and exploit that body towards its own means. The body, in a sense, is displaying restraint on its own actions, not overexploiting things so it can persist into the long term. But it also is a hunk of meat that can be exploited by a would-be cheater. So, to the extent that cooperation is important to fitness in microbial societies, the occurrence and spread of cheating individuals can be as deleterious to microbes as cancer is to a body. And going back to this little table from West et al., what we have over here, of course, is cheating. Cheating is when an individual receives some kind of positive effect, result from their behavior, and it occurs in conjunction with a negative impact on another individual. So a cheater, by defecting, is gaining resources, for example, and these come at the expense of the access of other individuals to those resources. Whether those resources are food, whether those resources are simply the body of an individual, that can be exploited, for example, by a parasite. So Travassino and Velisser have a number of terms that they define, and I'll just walk through these terms. So we've talked about altruism, behavior that has an individual fitness cost but provides a fitness benefit to others. Cooperative behavior in the presence of cheaters constitutes altruism towards the cheaters. In other words, if a cooperator is actually, if it's costing them to cooperate and they're putting forth some kind of energy, time, risk towards developing, for example, a public good, and then a cheater comes along and takes that public good. You could argue that, in fact, the cooperator is that there's a cost to providing a benefit to another individual, and therefore, with regard to that other individual, the cooperator is acting as as an altruist. Alternatively, cheating itself, obtaining benefits from collectively produced public good that are disproportionately large relative to the cheater's own contribution to that good. So a good example, as Travassino and Velisher make, is our cancer cells. With cancer cells, they're not contributing to the well-being of the body, but they're certainly partaking of the benefits supplied by the body, such as nutrients and a warm place to live. And so the cancer cells are clearly cheaters within a body consisting otherwise of non-cancer cells. Cheating load, so to the degree that to which the degree to which obligately defecting cheaters decrease the group level benefits of cooperation in chimeric social groups. So chimeric means there are both cheaters and cooperators present, both cooperators and defectors present within a group. If the fitness of a group as a whole is smaller given the presence of cheaters than it is given the absence of cheaters, then the difference between the two is cheating load. Again, getting back to the body, so you've got a body and the body is doing fine and it has some fitness associated with it, and it may have a lower fitness associated with it if, in fact, a parasite is infesting that body or a pathogen or cancer cells. And the difference in fitness between a body that is pathogen or parasite or cancer-free and one that, in fact, is infested or otherwise harboring these things, that difference is called the cheating load. Collective action, the combined effect of individual behaviors within a group. So, when you have benefits that are associated to cooperative behavior among individuals, that can be described as a collective action. And one example of a collective action is the production of some kind of public good. Another example is the restraint in exploitation of the commons that you can see among cooperators. Cooperation, proportional contribution of individuals to a collectively produced public good. So you've got something that is good for a group of organisms, and those organisms that, in fact, don't overexploit and even contribute to that good, those organisms can be described as cooperators. Defection, by contrast, disproportionately small contribution by individuals to a collectively produced public good. Biologically, defection does not necessarily entail cheating. that is the gaining of an advantage from a defection. Some mechanisms of defection might not enhance the relative ability of defectors to exploit a relevant public good. So I suppose that's debatable whether defection and cheating are always the same thing. I'm willing to accept that they're not. If we define cheating as something, as a defection behavior where you have some gain, and the defection is as not necessarily being associated with a gain that comes from that defection, I'm fine with those definitions. Nevertheless, typically there will be an equation between use of the word defection and cheating, but it's important to realize at least that there can be distinctions between these two terms in terms of their definitions. Kin selection. Kin selection turns out to be very important in the evolution of cooperation. This is natural selection for alleles shared by close relatives that might cause individuals to behave in a manner that is detrimental to their own individual fitness, but beneficial to the spread of the alleles under selection. Another way of saying this is that there can be benefits to providing favors to kin. At least not defecting against kin, simply because the kin harbor the same, or to a large extent, harbor similar or same alleles to you, to the individual, to the actor. Another way of thinking about this, though, is that within kin, there's opportunities for essentially reciprocal altruism, which we're not going to talk about too much here in terms of microorganisms. But basically, if you are helpful to a close relative, the close relative can be helpful to you in return, and together you can display a higher fitness as a consequence. However, reciprocal altruism actually is something that need not be associated with kin. It's possible for two individuals that are not closely related to, in fact, share favors among themselves, and therefore collectively display a greater fitness. So it is possible for individuals to, in fact, share genes and be cooperative towards one another. It's also possible for individuals that don't share alleles to be cooperative towards one towards each other. But the situation where, in fact, they share alleles, you have a much greater likelihood of that resulting in cooperative behavior or selection for cooperative behavior. And the reason for this is a consequence of what is known as kin selection. And then you have public good. Any fitness-enhancing resource that is accessible to multiple individuals within a local group, a pre-existing public good such as rainwater originates independently of the group that benefits from it. So this is an example of a commons, such as a pasture, where you can have multiple individuals in the group able to exploit that pasture. The pasture is a public good. The commons is a public good. But there are other kinds of public good and other kinds of commons. So alternatively, a collectively produced public good, such as an intercellular signal, is generated by members of groups that use it. We'll talk about extracellular polysaccharide in terms of biofilm formation as a potential public good. Public goods are found all through human societies. A major component of what governments are all about is providing public goods to the citizens within whatever the jurisdiction is of a government. And once again, just pointing out we have cheating up there. So how do you make cooperation compelling enough that organisms actually cooperate? The most obvious means of enforcing cooperation is actually to physically bind together would-be cooperators. And this is seen especially in multicellular organisms. So in this case, the would-be cooperators are the cells that make up the multicellular organism. Particularly, what's important is reproductive linkage between individuals. So long as you can set things up so that if an individual doesn't cooperate, it comes back to haunt them in the form of leading to a reduction in their long-term success, then you can have a compelling case for those organisms instead to cooperate. You can also think of this in terms of a tragedy of the commons. If you have two organisms that are together in the same place, and each of them provides benefits to the other, then if you defect against the other organism, it's essentially exploiting or over-exploiting the resources that you need, the commons within your environment. And this can lead to long or medium-term consequences that are detrimental to the individual that is, in fact, doing this defection behavior. And overall, this can result in selection for cooperation. But even with multicellularity, you still need mechanisms that inhibit cheating, that serve to limit the potential for individuals to cheat. So even with binding together all of these cells and even making their reproductive success all linked together in such a way that when one cheats, it actually comes back to haunt them, you still need mechanisms that lead to an inhibition of cheating. So one of these is for the cells that make up a multicellular organism to in fact be clonally related. And this is assured by how multicellular organisms form, at least most multicellular organisms, where they all start out as a single cell, for example, the zygote that we start out as. And that cell simply mitotically reproduces, and as a consequence, all the cells making up a body, more or less, are genetically identical to one another. So if one cell is able to give towards the collective benefit of the body, then you have that cell increasing its potential for reproductive success because the cells that ultimately are contributing to the next generation are clonally related to the cell that is providing this benefit. It's also helpful to have mechanisms of internal policing. So, for example, we have immune systems, and immune systems destroy cancer cells. Immune systems also destroy pathogens and parasites. And all of these represent cheaters within an otherwise cooperating group of individuals. And by having mechanisms whereby the cheaters can be identified and eliminated, you can retain the multicellular group. The body as a group of more or less cooperating individuals rather than this chimeric group consisting of both cooperators and defectors. Sequestration of germlines is also an important component whereby cooperation can be maintained in many multicellular organisms. And what this means essentially is that a cell that is a cheater, if it's a somatic cell that is not a germline cell, doesn't contribute to the next generation directly, then that cell is unable to contribute to the next generation. And in fact, by cheating against the body as a whole, it might reduce the reproductive success of the body and thereby essentially its own reproductive success. So sequestration of the germline means that certain cells early on during development are set aside as those cells that will give rise to the next generation. And therefore, the rest of the body, the only way those cells can contribute to the next generation, the only way they can display a reproductive success is, in fact, by making sure that the germline cells are happy and able to contribute to the next generation. And that requires cooperative behaviors on the part of those somatic cells. Microorganisms that typically invade otherwise empty niches and do so in very small numbers, such as at one individual, also may maintain genes encoding within population cooperative behaviors. And a good example of this is when a pathogen invades an otherwise unpathogen holding individual. And so, as a consequence, the resulting population of pathogens within these previously healthy individuals are all clonally related to one another, and therefore there's this potential for kin selection and selection for cooperative behavior. So restraint on virulence, which we'll look at in a couple of chapters hence, in the case of viral or bacterial pathogens or eukaryotic parasites, is an example where essentially by grouping together individuals that are genetically identical, you can have cooperative behavior occurring. And in this case, this is clearly an example of a tragedy of the commons, where the commons is the body that's being infected, and restraint on virulence is essentially restraint on overexploitation of the environment. And this is possible, this is can be selected for effectively when, in fact, a population of pathogens is clonally related. We'll get into this more as we get to talking about the evolution of virulence in a subsequent chapter. But basically, if you had an overly virulent individual, an overly exploiter of environments, then when that individual, if were able to be transmitted to a new individual to be infected, it would transmit as a highly virulent individual, and then you would have a highly virulent population of individuals. And if that level of virulence, the degree to which it makes the host organism sick, actually interferes with subsequent transmission of those individuals, then they'll represent a dead-end lineage. And as a consequence, what you end up with is selection for levels of virulence that essentially maximize transmission between individuals. And in many cases, that level of virulence is possible, is less than maximal of what the virulence the organism could potentially display. And those kinds of situations where you get selection for optimal levels of virulence, for optimal levels of exploitation of environments, these are really possible only under circumstances where, in fact, you've got a bunch of organisms that are closely related to one another, kin selection, clonally related in the case of many microorganisms, and as a consequence have a compelling reason to display behaviors that increase the potential for their kin to successfully reproduce, even if they themselves don't successfully reproduce. And one such behavior is restraint in terms of exploitation of environments. So congregation turns out to be particularly important for the evolution of cooperation. Bacteria are capable of congregating. They can congregate together in soils. They congregate especially as clonal groups, that is, groups of bacteria that don't separate from one another after they've been formed, forming colonies or microcolonies. The risk of such congregations is invasion by similarly congregation-positive individuals, which effect a growth advantage by partaking of public goods, of a public good without contributing to it. So you've got a group of bacteria. This group of bacteria is able to have display cooperative behavior within that group, but it's possible for that group to be invaded by cheaters, either via mutation or by what I call cheaters from without, individuals that move into microcolonies or groups of cells of would-be cooperators and take advantage of the situation, such as by partaking of a public good that's been produced by the individuals making up these groupings, but without contributing to that public good. So this partaking of these public goods without contributing to it are another example of a tragedy of the commons. This is basically making over-exploiting an environment. In this case, not so much taking too much of the environment, but instead of taking from the environment without contributing to its upkeep, which is sort of the same thing. Restraint basically is contributing to the upkeep of an environment by not over-exploiting that environment. So these kinds of ideas can be seen during biofilm formation among bacteria. We'll give an example later on of the potential for stealing of extracellular polysaccharide from other organisms, and in fact how that can be inhibited even among something as unsophisticated as a bacterium. Another example where you're stealing these public goods is where you have extracellular agents generally, so not just EPS, extracellular polysaccharide, but exoenzymes. Siderophores are a means by which bacteria gather up free iron from their environments, which tends to be limiting, and therefore these things contribute to the pathogenesis of certain bacteria. Exoenzymes, it's fairly easy to imagine how you can steal the exoenzymes, or at least the products. So you've got an exoenzyme, it's secreted, it goes out, it digests something in the environment so the digestive products can be brought back into the cell, but it's certainly easy enough to partake of the digestive products so that the organism that is producing the exoenzyme doesn't necessarily receive all of the digestate, but also the organism that is able to partake of these digestive products without actually producing the digestive enzyme essentially is getting something for free, a public good, and they're not contributing to it. again, there are mechanisms by which this kind of thing can be blocked. And in fact, they turn out to be similar to the mechanisms that keep individuals from stealing EPS. And they involve such things as congregating of cells into clonal lineages. Although, particularly if you can separate the cheaters from the cooperators before you establish the clonal lineages, then the cheaters are among nothing but cheaters, kind of like a cancer cell that's among nothing but cancer cells, and the cooperators can be among nothing but cooperators, at least from the start of the establishment of microcolonies. So cooperators generally, what do they need? What's necessary for cooperation to be an evolutionary stable strategy? Well, they need to band together. And so this typically is seen in the guise of some sort of spatial structure, that is some kind of limit on the movement of the organisms that are involved in cooperation. Ideally, they're physically linked together in some capacity. They must be phenotypically homogeneous in terms of cooperation. And that means that cooperators must be physically linked to other cooperators in order for mutual cooperation to occur. If they're physically linked to defectors, then you have the situation where essentially the cooperator is contributing to the fitness of the or functionality of the defector without getting anything in return. And one way to achieve this is essentially by individuals hanging out with kin, particularly with microorganisms. These can be clonally related individuals. So if you have a microcolony, starts with one cell, cell divides, the two cells don't separate from one another, they're clonally related cells, and they are physically banded together. And this is an ideal situation for cooperation serving as an evolutionarily stable strategy, as a stable strategy. To exclude defectors from the congregations is another important component of how evolution can favor cooperation. So not only should you have individuals be clonally related to for them to be associated with one another, for them to be all cooperators, but it's helpful to be able to keep the non-cooperators, the defectors from without, or the defectors from within, the ones that can arise via mutation, from finding their way into these bands of cooperators and stealing from them. And then it's also important to otherwise defect, to have means of suppressing defection if in fact defectors should find their ways into the midst of cooperators. So we've got banding together, we've got closely related so that they're sharing alleles, that's kin selection. It's helpful to set things up so that defectors are either not able to enter in with the same groupings as the cooperators or to form via mutation within those groupings. And even better if you've got mechanisms whereby defectors can be identified and eliminated. Of course, you see the latter, particularly among multicellular organisms and their immune systems, but really you see the same kind of thing among even bacteria. There are mechanisms whereby bacteria can knock out bacteriophages in their midst by, in fact, sacrificing individual cells towards getting rid of these bacteriophages. The bacteriophages are defector organisms, and the sacrifice of a cell so that the rest of a microcolony can survive can be viewed as an altruistic behavior. Or alternatively, it can be just viewed as an individual displaying a cooperative behavior within a group such that clonally related organisms also found within the same group are able to be reproductively successful. So this is a just a, another diagrammatic way of depicting these various ideas. And so what we have here is a group, and within this group is an individual, and the individual is giving, so contributing to the group. And this would be, by contrast, a defector, and the defector is taking, so the arrows are pointing towards it. So this defector can arise via mutation. So it's explicitly what may be going on here is that that individual is that a mutation occurs in that individual such that it's converted from being a cooperator to being a defector. So maybe there's some public good, and this individual produces the public good and contributes to its presence within the group, and this is a mutant that fails to produce the public good, such as failing to produce an extracellular polysaccharide that's maybe binding a microcolony, making up a biofilm together. So this is a net taking from the group. And as a consequence of that, the group loses. So this is the cheating load, the difference in size between these two groups. The defector potentially gains if it's a cheater from essentially not contributing to the overall group fitness, but contributing, biasing its behaviors towards contributing to its own fitness rather than that of the group as a whole. So this I would call defection from within or cheating from within, an individual that arises via mutation within a group and can compete and within that group and defect by essentially taking such as public goods from the group itself. Then there's the potential for defecting from without, where you have individuals such as parasites, and these parasites are able to invade groups of other individuals. And these groups of other individuals are potentially cooperators. The parasite comes in and takes, 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 and as a consequence, similarly, you end up with these cheating, these costs to cheating, these cheating loads that are associated with having these defectors within these now chimeric groups of individuals. They no longer consist just of cooperators, but instead consist of both cooperators and defectors. So spatial structure or physical structure is important to cooperation. How can cooperators interact preferentially with one another? Two common explanations exist. First, cooperators can recognize other cooperators or relatives, which are likely to be cooperators as well because they share alleles. Although such discrimination has been demonstrated even for microbes, its requirements for are substantial and probably not often fulfilled. Alternatively, individuals do not recognize one another, but relatives remain spatially close together and thus interact preferentially. This requires that the physical environment is structured so that dispersal of newborn individuals is limited. So spatial structure is automatically generated simply by the asexual division of immotile cells, which leads to clonal clusters, microcolonies. This self-organized structure merely needs to be maintained. So among bacteria, how do you establish these clonal groupings of individuals? You can just start with one cell, and if its daughter cells don't separate from the parent cells, you end up with a clump of cells, and that clump of cells, because they're clonally related, should represent a group of cooperating individuals. Although alternatively, they can represent a group of defecting individuals, and as we'll see, that is one mechanism by which cooperation can be stabilized within in communities or populations, simply by setting things up so that the cooperators are sticking together and the defectors are forced to stick with each other and thus are selected against as groups relative to the groupings of cooperators. And then a problem, though, is that structure may not be an absolute barrier to movement, such that cheaters may still be able to invade isolated colonies of cooperators or may arise among cooperators by mutation. So you have this potential for cheating to arise either from within or from without these groups of cooperators. And so it's not good enough for cooperators simply to form into these clonal groupings of cooperating individuals. They also have to have mechanisms whereby they prevent other organisms, parasites or predators or pathogens, or instead have, for example, cancer cells arising by mutation within their midst. They have to have means by which they can block these things so that they can maintain themselves as groups of cooperators rather than chimeric individuals consisting of both cooperators in combination with defectors. The basic idea that you see cooperation, particularly among organisms that are clonally related, where those organisms have been initiated from a single cell, where a multicellular organism or instead a microcolony of these clonally related cells, these cooperators, have all gotten together and they've stayed together and they've formed together, and therefore they can cooperate with each other without having to worry about cheaters in their midst, or at least not having to worry as greatly. That really is the paradigm of how cooperation can evolve, particularly among microorganisms. And it's when we see what seem to be exceptions to that idea that we are most baffled, that we want to look more closely, because it's in these circumstances that we may gain further insight into exactly what is required in order for cooperation to evolve in otherwise very simple systems. An example of a system where organisms, in fact, do not start out as a single cell and then the cells remain tightly linked together, physically linked together, as cooperators, is seen with the bacterium Myxococcus, and also among the cellular slime molds. They're actually similar systems, although one's a prokaryote and one's a eukaryote. With the Myxococcus, these cells actually, to a degree, are cooperative, even as individual cells. They display what's been described as a wolf pack hunting strategy, where a number of cells excrete extracellular enzymes that then kill and digest other bacteria and other things, which then can be consumed by the cells making up the wolf pack. So there is this potential for some kind of cooperative behavior, even when the cells are otherwise seen as individual cells rather than congregations of cells. However, when the environment becomes depleted in nutrients, these cells are able to congregate together. But instead of congregating together as a single cell that starts out and divides and the daughter cells stay together, these are actually seemingly separate cells. Free living cells, cells that are swimming about on their own or moving about on their own, that then come together into what is essentially a fruiting body that is forming. And the object of these fruiting bodies is to produce spores. And in fact, the spores are produced in such a way that they're raised up sufficiently out of the substrate or above the substrate, the soil, or the litter on top of the soil, such that the spores can be released into the wind and therefore find their way to new locations. So these guys, these spores basically are the babies. And the idea is that individual bacteria come together to form these fruiting bodies in order to make the best babies they can. The catch is that not all of the cells that are involved in these fruiting bodies, remember, these are a bunch of cells that are getting together. They're not starting out as necessarily clonally related cells. These cells, not all of them actually get to produce spores, and so that suggests altruism. And whenever you see altruism, you should suspect that there's some kind of mystery going on. We really don't expect altruism in a strictest sense to occur. We don't expect one organism to be sacrificing themselves for another organism with nothing gaining except for the organism that has received the cooperative behavior from the first organism's sacrifice. But that's exactly what we're seeing here. We're seeing cells that contribute to these stalks of the fruiting body that are not going to be contributing to the production of spores, and therefore they are, in a sense, sacrificing themselves for the sake of other organisms being able to reproduce. And the question is, how is that possible? And the answers should be something along the lines of that despite the fact that we have free cells that are getting together to form these congregations of cells, these cooperating cells. We should have mechanisms that exclude the defectors from their midst in some capacity. There should be something that is either required of the cells that make up the fruiting bodies, such that they can stay in those fruiting bodies, or alternatively, that it makes a compelling case, so far as these bacteria are concerned, that the cells making up these fruiting bodies, in fact, are all clonally related. It's no mystery if you can set things up so that the cells that are supporting the production of the spores, but not making spores themselves, are clonally related to the cells that make the spores, because that's essentially the same thing that goes on in a multicellular organism where you've got a soma that's not contributing to the next generation and a germline that is. In a sense, the spore-making cells are the germline and the rest are non-germline cells or somatic cells. And so long as everything is clonal, everything is cool. But if everything is not clonal, then you really have to come up with good explanations for how exactly it is that these cells should be willing, the ones that don't contribute to the formation of spores, should be willing to, in fact, contribute to the formation of spores by other individuals. So, in other words, we've got a fairly good bead on the idea of the congregation of clonally related cells, that they essentially form as groups of cells through the division of the cells involved. And then they stay together, and they have some mechanism whereby they keep cheaters out, either cheaters that arise from mutation or ones that come from outside as parasites. That is a very compelling story as to how cooperation can evolve within microorganisms, and as we'll see, within organisms that are not so micro, such as ourselves. And it's when we see exceptions to those ideas that we have to question exactly how it is these exceptional organisms are able to pull off cooperation without making up essentially a single body. And those are interesting stories, and often kin selection is involved and other mechanisms are involved. But the important point is that we have a fairly robust story for understanding how, in fact, cooperation can evolve even within microbial systems. And it has a lot to do with clonally related organisms sticking together and cooperating with each other rather than cooperating with other organisms that can be defectors. So this is an aggregation of free-living cells to form these fruiting bodies. And note that not all cells leave spores. Are the non-spore formers altruists? And the way we've been using the word altruists, if they are altruists, then we need a good explanation for why it is that they're altruists. Alternatively, it's possible that these are generally just clonally related groups of cells, in which case there's no real mystery as to how they can pull off the cooperative behavior of producing fruity bodies that release spores into the wind that then can find their way to new locations. So the idea of a public or common good is important to the idea of evolution of cooperation. And in fact, in the fruiting body we just saw with the Myxococcus, the public good is whatever it is that contributes to the formation of those fruiting bodies. And clearly the organisms that are forming spores are partaking of that common good. The real question is what about the organisms, the individual cells that contribute to the public good but don't actually get a payoff from it in the form of spore formation? But in any case, we're talking about a public good. And the public good is contributing in many cases to the fitness of organisms, to their reproductive success. So note that it is not at all uncommon for unrelated individuals to compete over common resources. One name for such competition is interspecific competition, which we can describe as a negative-negative interaction, because by competing for resources, each individual that's doing the competing, it has less access to resources in total because another individual's also obtaining those resources. So both parties can lose. One, the sucker, loses especially if one party is enhancing their growth at the expense of their efficiency of resource utilization. So if you've got two individuals competing over a common resource, and one individual is being very efficient in its utilization of the resource, but as a consequence of essentially displaying restraint, it's not growing as fast, or it's not exploiting the resources as fast. Alternatively, you can have another organism that is able to exploit the resources fast, but it's not necessarily exploiting the resources efficiently. It's not displaying the same kind of restraint. So when you have an individual that displays restraint, basically in the same environment competing with an individual that doesn't display restraint, you can call the not restrained individual a defector, the restrained individual a cooperator, and in terms of the prisoner's dilemma, we would call the cooperator a sucker. So bodies are a common good among body cells. And cancer and pathogens are, in fact, genetically divergent cheaters. These are individuals that can form or invade into bodies. And the bodies are a group of cooperators, and they've got various common goods that they contribute to. And then the cancers and the pathogens take advantage of these common goods without necessarily contributing to them. Extracellular enzymes, as we noted, as well as siderophores, are a common good used in, for example, extracellular digestion by bacteria and fungi. We also have extracellular enzymes. We secrete these things into our digestive tract, but these are not a common good in a traditional sense because they are not being used by any other individual except for ourselves. Whereas with bacteria, they don't have the extracellular enzymes contained within their own bodies. They're external to their bodies. But even with ourselves and extracellular enzymes, it still can be viewed as a common good because remember, our own bodies are made up of multiple cells. And if you think of each of those cells as an individual, we don't necessarily have to, but if we did, then the extracellular enzymes that are produced represent a common good to the cells making up our body. Now the question is, how do you keep cheaters from taking advantage of these common goods? In our own bodies, we do it because essentially our cells are clonally related. So as long as the cells are genetically identical, there really aren't any cheaters. There's no altruism associated with making these extracellular enzymes because all of the individuals that partake of the digestive products of those enzymes are clonally related. However, if you don't have cells that are clonally related, then those individuals potentially can be partaking of the digestive products of the extracellular enzymes, the common good, and they can utilize them without actually producing the extracellular enzymes. Even in our cells, we've got all of this microflora. They're living off of something, and one of the things that they live off of, an important one, is in fact the products of our of extracellular digestion that we effect by producing these enzymes. So animals avoid this conflict by extracellular digesting within a clonally related environment, ex at least mostly clonally related, as far as our own cells are concerned. And phagotrophic protists, as well as porifrins, the sponges, and also to a degree gram-negative bacteria, also avoid this conflict by instead of producing extracellular enzymes, they instead digest intracellularly. So if you're digesting intracellularly, even if it's just within the periplasm, in the case of the gram-negative bacteria, in the case of the protists and the porifrins, these are phagocytic organisms, so they digest within phagolysosomes inside their own cells. If you are digesting intracellularly, then your digestive enzymes are not a public good because they're not publicly available. And it's only when you're excreting the enzymes outside of your body or outside of your cells that, in fact, they can be a public good and thereby be utilized in their functions by organisms other than those that produce the extracellular enzymes. Another example of these ideas is when an organism is a victim organism of some exploiter. So, for example, bacteria represent a common resource or common good among pathogens of bacteria, such as bacteriophages. And so, what we have is a resource that is acquired by these phages as organisms and utilized. And in fact, you can have competition among the phages where some phages are more efficient exploiters and other phages may be more, as the word is, expedient exploiters. And therefore, you have competition, what is essentially between cheaters and cooperators. And we'll get to that example subsequently. But often, when you see cooperation, you're seeing some kind of public good, even if the public good is just a failure to is an environment that's not been completely overly exploited. You have something that individuals have the potential of together partaking of, and therefore you have some potential for one individual to take more than its fair share, or alternatively to take the same amount but not be contributing to either the formation or the upkeep of the public good.